some of this out of my way. Yeah, that, of course, that was up here.
Yeah, that's true.
Thanks, Melanie, for that nice introduction. This is our 70th birthday party. AA is 70 years old today, and it... Yeah. And it actually happened on the 10th of June, too. That's the date today. What an honor to be asked to speak here tonight. You know, 28 years ago, I never thought I'd be talking in front of all of you people. And I've chosen to go first tonight because I'm not called Marge in Charge for no reason at all. Some people think I'm kind of bossy, but I think I'm in Marge in Charge because I don't have a handle on this control issue yet. I'm an alcoholic and my name is Marge. Hi, everyone. Before we share our experience, strength, and hope with you, we'd like to welcome our AA and Al-Anon families from all over these United States and some faraway nations. A special hello to our Akron AAs and Al-Anon. You are indeed our family. we got a lot of them sitting over here. I don't have my glasses on, so I can't see you. I did that purposely because I thought I was going to be pretty nervous, so I thought, if I don't wear my glasses, I can't see beyond the first row. But I will surely be able to feel the love in this room. I know that you all love me, and I love you in return. And a real loving welcome to our family. Our two sons are here tonight. Two of our grandchildren and our wonderful, wonderful daughter-in-law, and they're sitting right here in the second row, and we're very proud of them and so glad they came tonight. They've never heard us speak. Unfortunately, our two daughters live out of town and weren't able to come. To you new folks attending Founders Day for the first time, you're going to be on a real high this weekend. There's a new and better way coming for you. Just follow our path, and everything's going to be okay. My sobriety date is March 3rd, 1977, and my home group is St. Thomas Panel. Unfortunately, they are meeting as I speak, so not all of my buddies could be here tonight. A few are, though, and John wanted me to say hello to him from the stage. So, hi, John, wherever you are. I was told when I came into AA that I would have to change everything but my name. Everything would have about me would have to be changed. And I'll reveal to you in my story how I've changed, how I've grown, how I've recaptured the wonder of life and living. I'm a reasonably happy, healthy, content person. And I have peace and serenity today. And these are some of my fringe benefits of Alcoholics Anonymous. They're called the 12 Promises. And they're found on pages 83 and 84 of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I had to throw that in because I'm not a page person. I don't know anything about the pages. I never can remember pages. I know the first 164 pages, but... Other than that, I'm not a page person. I have about 40 bookmarks in my big book. But my friend here knows all the pages, and his Al-Anon friends tease him all the time about, you know, anytime they want to know page, they just ask Bob. The first promise says we are going to know a new freedom and a new happiness. I like to call this my new and better way of living today. I don't take any of these wonderful things for granted. My AA meetings are my classroom, and the program is my life. My favorite slogan is one day at a time. And after a whirlwind period of several years trying to be super wife and super mom, I finally learned to slow down and live my life one day at a time. I'm an alcoholic who is one drink away from a drunk, and I'm trying to stay away from that drink one day at a time. So let me slow down now and ask you to join me in the serenity prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know. Amen. Several years ago, I led a meeting, and during the comment period, some lady told me that she enjoyed my story, but she said, you know, you talked about how AA had saved your marriage, and she said, I would have liked to have heard more about how AA saved your life. And, you know, I was really stunned because I thought I made it quite clear how AA had saved my life. And since that time, I have read January 6th in my 24-hour-a-day book. I've read it every day. I've passed that message along to other people, and I have other people who read January 6th all the time, too. And I want to read it to you because this is where I stand. Keeping sober is the most important thing in my life. The most important decision I ever made was my decision to give up drinking. I am convinced that my whole life depends on not taking that first drink. Nothing in the world is as important to me as my own sobriety. Everything I have, my whole life depends on that one thing. Can I afford ever to forget this, even for 1 minute? No, I can't ever afford to forget that. Tonight my best friend is here with me, sharing the stage with me. He's my husband, Bob. And most of the Akronites that are here tonight know Bob. And the rest of you will feel as though you know Bob after I finish talking. Since he plays an important part of my story, he held my hand and he walked along with me on this 28-year journey. He loved me when I didn't love myself. He may not have liked what I was doing, but he loved me. Today he loves what I'm doing, and he likes me. I'll tell you a little bit about myself. I was born 73 years ago in Buffalo, New York. And are those the Buffalonians over there? I'm hanging on to every minute of those 73 years because I'm going to be 74 on Monday. I was raised to be a lady. I came from a very happy home with nice parents. I have one brother who's 11 years older than I am. And alcohol was not a problem in my home. I was born during the Depression, and we were poor. Somebody else, one of the earlier speakers tonight, was born during the Depression, too. I didn't know we were poor because everybody was poor at that time. And small children don't really realize what being poor is all about. My parents were naturalized Americans and were both very, very smart, bright people. My mom was smart in the arts. She loved music and the theater and poetry, and she had a beautiful singing voice and she had a phenomenal memory. And my dad was a book reader, especially American history. Education was very important in our house. And I think it was my father's goal that my brother and I would both graduate from college. When my brother graduated from high school in the 30s, the Depression was at its height, and you couldn't even buy a job then. There was no way to get a job, and so he went into the Navy. And he rose to be a lieutenant commander in the Navy on a high school education. And, of course, after the war, he went to college on his GI Bill, and he graduated from MIT. And I wanted to be a school teacher, But I was in a big hurry to get a job, and of course the war made money more plentiful because there were so many jobs during the war, because all the men were in the army and it was the people left at home could have their choice of jobs. And I was in a hurry to get that job and buy things. I guess I was kind of a mercenary or something like that, you know, thinking about buying material things. I was materialistic, I guess. And so the war availed the opportunity that my father would have the money to send me to school. And I chose to go 2 years to college, and I took a course in secretarial science, and I got an associate's degree. And I was happy with that because I got a job. I got a good job right away with General Motors in Buffalo. And it was at this time that I met the man who was to become my husband. When he got graduated from college, he got a job, and they immediately transferred him to Ohio, Akron, Ohio. And we wrote each other. But we never called because his dad was manager of the Western Union, and of course the telephone company was their biggest competition. And so he wouldn't have dreamed of giving the competition the money, you know, by calling me, so he wrote me a letter. And stamps were only 3 cents back then. A year later he came back to Buffalo and we got married. We went on our honeymoon, drove to Akron. He had rented an upper flat in Goodyear Heights, and we got here on a Sunday night, and Monday morning he left for his job. He was a salesman, and he traveled all week. And here I was, you know, I didn't know anybody in Akron, Ohio. I didn't know anybody in the whole state of Ohio, and he left me. Well, I could see the smokestacks of the Goodyear Tire and Rubber Company out my window. And even if I couldn't see the smokestacks, I could see the lamp black filtering in and landing on my windowsills. And so I walked over. Well, I stood it for 2 weeks, you know, being in this apartment all by myself and not knowing anyone, not having a car, not going anyplace. And so, you know, I felt pretty sorry for myself. And so I walked over to Goodyear, and they hired me right on the spot, and I was to go to work in the advertising department. I remained there for 7.5 years. Now, when Bob and I got married, we wanted children very badly. And after 2 years of marriage, we bought a house in Cuyahoga Falls, and we still live in that same house. And after 7 years, Bob and I still didn't have these children that we wanted, so we applied for adoption of a child. And within 5.5 years, we had 4 children, 2 boys and 2 girls that we had adopted, and that's called Planned Parenthood, you know, 2 boys, 2 girls, just the way we wanted it. And the happiest days of my life were the days that we brought those little babies into our home, brought them home. It was really pretty neat. And I set out to be super mom. I was going to have the brightest, the most intelligent, high achieving children who would excel in sports but never get dirty. We had a big backyard at that time. We don't anymore because since then we've added on twice to our house. But at that time we had a very big backyard, and our 4 children would play out there all the time, and they would probably bring home 15 additional children, and our yard was the neighborhood playground. And I would go out there to supervise, and you know, they came to play there and scream there, and they threw sand in each other's hair, and they fought over the swings, and they did a number with the hose all the time. And frankly, they drove me nuts. They were driving me crazy because I sat out there in that backyard with them every day. I was so overwhelmed with these four children that I wanted so badly. You know, I wanted them, and they just simply overwhelmed me. And every day I sat out there with them in the backyard, one day in, I don't know, 1967, 68, 69, somewhere in there, I went in the house and I mixed myself a drink. And I don't know where that came from because, you know, we were social drinkers, but we didn't really drink. And so I mixed that drink. I brought it out in the backyard with me, and I fell in love with that drink that day. It blotted out all the unpleasantness. In a few years, I became a daily drunk complete with blackouts. I felt that I had ungrateful children. I had an ungrateful husband. I blamed them for my drinking. They were the fault. And this is the same as every alcoholic does, you know. It's always someone else's fault. We never take the responsibility. An alcoholic will tell you if his wife would stop nagging him, he wouldn't have to drink so much. Or if his boss would get off his back, he could get to work on time and give him a good day's work. That's just the way we are. It's a natural impulse for us to justify our actions. Being honest with ourselves is not easy. I drank to escape, and I was afraid of taking responsibility. Today, I don't blame anyone else. I take responsibility for my drinking. I own it. Our home became a battleground. Mrs. Cleaver here made mountains out of molehills. I loved to cook and bake, but, you know, I was no longer capable of doing this. After I got the kids off to school in the morning, I'd cook dinner, or I'd bake a cake or something. And then come supper time, you know, all I'd have to do is heat this up. But I wasn't capable of doing that any longer either because I burned it. What a life for my husband and my children. You know, alcoholism surely is a family disease. My husband was at his wit's end. He didn't know what to do. He was the dad, the mom. He was the wage earner. He was the arbitrator of all these fights and arguments. You know, God didn't seem to be paying too much attention to me. I'd kneel down in church every Sunday morning and I'd ask God not to let me drink so much. Excuse me. Never dawned on me to ask God to help me stop drinking altogether. No, I asked him to help me not drink so much. In 1975, Bob asked me if I thought perhaps I needed some help with my drinking. And, you know, I said yes, and it was like a weight off my shoulders. It was, you know, just wonderful. And I knew Bob would take care of me. And he did. You know, he called the intergroup office. He did it for me. He talked to a very nice lady at the intergroup office, and she, you know, finally after he talked to her so long, she says, could I talk to the person who has the drinking problem? So after, you know, Bob put me on the phone, and she asked me if I could come to the office where we could have a one-on-one talk. And I said yes, and she said, well, you can bring your husband with you if you'd like. And so we did. We went downtown. I think it was on High Street then. Yeah. And that nice lady was Jessica O'Neill, and she was Rob Watling's mother. Rob's sitting right over here. And Rob likes me to talk about his mother, and I like to talk about his mother because she was my very first contact with Alcoholics Anonymous. And she was just a wonderful person, and she was wonderful to me. She held me in her arms, and she let me cry. You know, this was a shameful, humbling, embarrassing situation for me. But it gave me new insight about myself, certainly made me more sensitive to others. You know, where had that lady gone that I was raised to be? I was a hopeless alcoholic. I knew nothing about AA, you know. I knew what a lot of you knew, you know, of visions of, like most people, of men dressed in army coats under the bridge drinking cheap stuff out of a brown paper bag. I thought that's what an alcoholic was. In my own way, this is what I had become. Jessica held my hand, and she told me her story. And she said, I could have that good life too if I followed her path. She asked me if I could go to a meeting that night. And she says, can you go to a meeting tonight? And that was the key word, see, can you go to a meeting tonight? She did not say to me, can you go to a meeting tonight, tomorrow night, the next night, and every night of your life? She didn't say that. She said, can you go to a meeting tonight? If she'd said to the other, I would have been out of there. But she didn't do that. Jessica told me she had to get me a sponsor. At that time, they appointed people for you. And she called a lady named Audrey, who lived close to me in Carter Falls. And Audrey asked if I could come over to visit after I dropped my husband off at home. Well, I took Bob home, and I was so nervous. You know, here was this long day down at the intergroup office, and then they're going to send me over to somebody else's house, and we're going to talk more about drinking. And so I said, okay, you know, I could come. I dropped Bob off, and I went in the house, and I had to have a drink. So I drank this big glass of something. I don't even know what it was now, but it was a big glass. I got over to Audrey's house, and she says to me, have you been drinking? And I said, no. And, you know, she probably smelled me coming up her driveway. But I didn't know anything about honesty then either. Audrey said we would go to a meeting called Teen School. But that didn't mean anything to me. And she said she would pick Bob and I up. And when she came to our house, she said, we have to pick another girl up. And her name is Janet. Audrey asked if I knew where a certain street was, and I said, you know, of course I did. I said, yes. Now, I had a very dear friend named Janet that lived on that street. It was a very short street with about five houses on it. Now, what's the chance of having two Janets on that street? See? Well, there was no chance at all. It was my friend Janet. Now, I wanted to go to an AA meeting. I wanted to sit in a chair. I wanted to look straight ahead. I didn't want to look to the left. I didn't look to the right. I didn't want to see anybody I knew. I didn't want anybody to shake my hand. Nothing. I just wanted to sit in a chair. Well, that wasn't going to happen. I didn't even get out of my driveway before she tells me we're going to pick up my friend. I wanted to drop through the bottom of the car. Well, we went, and Janet comes bouncing out of her house. And, you know, it made no difference to Janet. She was just her same beaming self, you know, and real bubbly person she was. And she spied Bob in the back seat of the car, and she looked at him, and she says, wow, Bob, I didn't know you had a drinking problem. See, she thought Bob was the drunken boy. That suited me fine. Well, Janet has passed away now, but it was a blessing in disguise that she was there that night, because my sponsor had five children, and she was a school teacher at Falls High, and she didn't really have the time to take me to a lot of meetings. So Janet was my blessing in disguise. Janet and I palled around, and we went to lots and lots of meetings together. And I loved AA. I really liked it. I read the big book in one day. And I did steps that I thought applied to me. You know, not number two. How could I be restored to sanity, you know, when I was never insane? Little did I know, you know, much was to be revealed to me. I went to lead meetings, never discussion meetings. I wasn't discussing my life with anyone. I'm an avid reader, and you know, the leads that I heard, they were like real live novels. I heard about bank robberies and murder and being in the penitentiary and, you know, terrible things. And I had never done any of these things, so, oh, I loved it. I ate it all up, you know. I had, like Mary Frances used to say, you haven't done it yet. I went along with this for a whole year, and, you know, not listening, not drinking, but not doing anything to change. You know, I was the same old person. I was resentful of my family because nothing changed at home. You know, nobody was cooperating with me. They were all proud of me for going to AA, but they and that I wasn't drinking, but they weren't doing anything to help me. And, you know, I needed some help. And so I thought, well, I'll show them. You know, I'll show them. I'll drink. And it's exactly what I did. I drank. And, you know, picking up a drink after a period of sobriety is not like picking up the first drink in your life. It's like picking up the drink where you left off the last time. And it was a rapid decline to hell. Drinking was no fun anymore. The alcohol wasn't working. In a very short time, I became a totally irresponsible drunk. Now, Bob hadn't traveled for years, and there's nothing like a drunk having her watchdog with her 24/7. And his office was at home by this time, so I became a very sneaky drinker. I hid bottles every place, but then I'd have blackouts and I'd forget where I hid the bottles. And so I wrote notes to myself. Yeah, but then I lost the notes. Lordy, what a mess I was, and what a merry-go-round I was on. I did lots of wash because I knew I had bottles down in the basement. I spent lots of time down in that basement. One day with the bottle up to my mouth, I turned around and there was Bob standing on the top step watching me. But by this time, you know, by this time he had gone to Al-Anon and he learned how to detach with love. And boy, did he learn that lesson good. And, you know, my car broke down one day at the state liquor store. And I had to call him and come to have him come and get me. And Bob was not a holler or a screamer or anything. He just didn't talk to me. You know, we drove home in complete silence. He came and got me. But we drove home in silence. You know, my friend Joan tells in her lead how her son Matt came to the bar room every day and begged her to come home. And, see, my kitchen was my bar room, and my children were in my bar room right there with me. I no longer fell asleep at night. I passed out. I'd wake up in the middle of the night covered in sweat. I still sweat. And I'd reach under the bed for my bottles. Then I'd pass out again. You know, I was no longer living. I was just merely existing. I was not a nice person. I hated to see the sun come up because it meant another day, and, you know, I was still alive and I was afraid of living. Excuse me. I was an unfit mother and wife. I was so sick and tired of living this way. You know, I didn't have a lost weekend. I had lost years. I tried to be all things to all people and it was impossible. So I medicated myself with alcohol, lots of alcohol. I'll leave it up to Bob to tell you how much. I wasn't who I wanted to be. No way did I want to be the way I was living at that time. And I knew where to go. I wanted to be sober for me, not for anyone else, not for my husband, not for my children. I wanted to be sober for me. And that's the way it has to be. We have to want it. I went back to my home group, and Andy Tappa said, "We've been waiting for you." And he put his arm around me. He said, there was a seat here waiting for you. I knew I had to attend frequent meetings and really, really read that big book and keep it those 12 steps all the rest of my life, one day at a time. The meetings are my classroom. They're a matter of life and death to me. I learn in these classrooms of mine. I learn what could happen to me if I choose to go back and drink. I learn how to apply the 12 steps to my daily life. At my home group, we review the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous the first 12 weeks of the new year, and that's such a joyous time to me to go over and over these steps. And you know, it's really funny because I started Alcoholics Anonymous in the first part of the year when they were reviewing these steps, and they didn't make any sense to me at all. But, of course, if you stick around for a while, you know, you'll learn. I've learned to pray in AA. You know, I have no more gimme prayers. My prayers today are for guidance and thanks. I start each day asking for this guidance. I've gained a spirituality, and I've learned to meditate on the good things in life today. Before you know it, there's no room for resentments and self-pity. I've learned to trust and believe in my higher power, and my higher power is God. And to turn my will and my life over to my God on a daily basis. I thank God each night. And for a while I thought he had abandoned me, but he was carrying me through my deepest despair. I have a very deep sense of gratitude for Alcoholics Anonymous. I'll never be able to repay for what I've been given. But I'm an active member, and this stage is no place for me to brag about what I do or toot my own horn. But I'd like to mention a couple of things that are special to me, and one of them is sponsoring. And I sponsor a lot of girls, and most of them are here tonight. And last Monday was the anniversary of one of my sponsees, and she now lives in California. And on Sunday, I called her, and she wasn't home. So I called her sister here in Akron and left a message and said, tell Jesse that I called her to wish her a happy anniversary, and that Bob and I would be speaking at Founders Day. And so the next day, the telephone rang, and it was Jesse calling, I thought, from California. And here she was right here in town, and she wanted to surprise me, and she ran into me this morning, you know, that was a huge surprise. And sponsoring it's just so wonderful. It's, you know, one alcoholic talking to another, and it's what it's all about. And I firmly believe that you cannot sponsor talking for a few minutes before and after a meeting to someone. So, boy, we've had hundreds of mini meetings in our house, and then we have mini AA and Al-Anon meetings right in our family room. You know, it's so rewarding when you're working with a new person to see that sparkle come back in their eyes. The other thing that I find equally rewarding is the fact that Bob and I talk at the hospital to the patients and their families, St. Thomas Hospital for you out-of-towners, and we talk at the outpatient treatment facility. And I like to go around the room and shake everybody's hand, all the patients' hands and their families, and, you know, ask their names. One night when we were talking there, there was a young 19-year-old boy, and of course I could tell by the way he talked that he was from Scotland, and he told me his name, and he said, I was born in Scotland, and I'd only been here for a few months. And I said, well, I'm a first-generation American, and my parents were born in Scotland. And he looked at me, and he says, ooh, were they drunks? Now, you know, he could tell by the look in my face that he'd hurt my feelings because I had wonderful parents, and for anybody to ask me if my parents were drunks, And he said, well, I'm sorry if I offended you, but he said, that's a way of life there. And I said, well, okay. So I had a hard time concentrating on that night, what I was going to say to these patients, you know, because my mind kept going back to this. And my mind that night traveled back 60 years, traveled back to the time that I was about 10 years old, and my mother and father had a very dear friend who was a widower, and my mother would ask him over for dinner quite frequently, and I loved it when he came, and I called him Uncle Charlie, and one of the reasons I loved it when he came was because he brought my mother and I a box of candy, and he brought my father a bottle of whiskey. And I distinctly remembered that night that I was at St. Thomas Hospital. I remembered when I was 10 years old hearing my mother say to him, you can't quit until it's gone, can you? So maybe this is where I got my alcoholic gene. But, you know, maybe it's fortunate we were living in the Depression and my father didn't have any money to buy alcohol. You know, today I like myself. I can look in the mirror today and say, you know, you're not so bad. And there was a time I hated myself. If I didn't like me, I couldn't like all of you in this room, and I love all of you in this room. If I didn't care what happened to me, I wouldn't care at all what happened to you. You know, I said earlier that I was not a nice person, but I was a very sick person. I know what real friendship is today. I know how to love and accept love in return. I've regained the love and the respect of my wonderful children and my husband. I love life today. Every day to me is a gift. No one promised me a rose garden. You know, there's going to be a few thorns thrown along that path. But today, you know, I've been given tools in this fellowship to work with. They're my coping tools. Well, Bob and I have been married 52 years, and we have 6 wonderful grandchildren. In 1985, our first grandchild was born. I'm telling you this, and I didn't know she was coming tonight. You know, she's right down here in front of me. And she's the light of our life. And when we were, when she was a little toddler, she was at the kitchen table with me and making something crafty, and she asked me how to do something, and I told her, and she said, oh, Grandma, you know how to do everything. And her mother said, no, Lauren, you know, only God knows everything. And she said, that's right, God and Grandma. But there's a funnier one on Bob, because Bob used to babysit her one day a week while her mother worked. And so Bob bought candy cigarettes, and, you know, he mixed a cup of milk with a few drops of coffee. And when her mother came home from work, she says, well, what did you and Papa do today? And Lauren says, oh, we smoked cigarettes and drank coffee. I'd like to tell you that AA did save my marriage, but foremost it saved my life and allowed me to become a loving, sober partner in this marriage. Thanks for being here. Thanks for listening. If you want to join me on this journey, all you have to do is go to meetings, get a sponsor, get a home group, pray, work the steps, read the book, and listen and learn. And you too will be given this wonderful gift of sobriety. God bless all of you. Thank you very much for listening.